walked back to the cage. Sark. Migos. Inside the cage, Draven Sark slowly stood up. He looked around, blinking at the light, his naked, emaciated body suddenly upright and straight-backed.
"Have I been asleep?" he asked.
His voice was thin and dry, but it had lost its deranged flutter.
"Yes, for a while," said Koblika.
"Can I come out, Koran? Can I come out of the cage now, please?"
"Not yet, Migos," said Koblika.
"Have I been asleep?"
"Yes," said Koblika.
"The dreams are bad," said Sark. "I don't like them."
"I know, Migos, but they will be over soon."
"You promised that last time, Goran,"
Sark said, looking reproachfully at Koblika.
"You promised I could come out."
"The work is important, you know that," said Koblika. "But I mean it this time."
"Is it time to weave again?"
asked Sark. He put his hand to his forehead and kneaded his brow.
"I don't think I'm strong enough. I feel like everything is slipping away. Everything is dark at the edges, Goran, closing in on me. When I weave, I walk out into the darkness, Goran, into dark places. It's very lonely. I don't want to go back out there any more."
"You always say that," Koblika said soothingly.
Sark looked at him sharply through the bars. Anger spiked in him.
"Because it's true," he cried. "How many years have I spent in the dark now? Eh? It feels like centuries. These brief moments of light and wakefulness are too rare. I have sacrificed my life for the king, Koblika. My life."
"Then you won't want that sacrifice to be in vain, will you?" asked Koblika.
"What do you mean by that?"
asked Sark.
"I haven't roused you to weave, Migos," said Koblika. "There's more weaving to be done, but not today. The hall is under threat."
"Threat?"
"The Inquisition has found us," said Koblika.
"How the hell could they have done?"
asked Sark, horrified.
"Kestra is extymate. It is hidden from all, unless I invite them in. I have taken great pains."
"And now you must take greater ones," said Koblika. "Gregor Eisenhorn is here, in this tower. He will undo all you have done. Your life's work. You must start the loom. You must find him and speak out the means to nullify him."
"Eisenhorn,"
said Sark quietly.
"Really here?"
"Yes."
"I never thought he'd have the guile to get this close,"
said Sark. He glanced at Koblika.
"You're right, of course, Goran. He must be purged. Are there materials to hand?"
"Some," said Koblika. "A few bodies in storage. Failed test subjects. Ones we haven't disposed of yet. Some other corpses, too. You'll find them once you start."
"Go open up storage, Goran,"
Sark said. He knelt down and looked at Koblika through the bars.
"Do you want him dead, Goran?"
he asked.
"Or do you want him to suffer first?"
"Oh, I want him to suffer, Migos," said Koblika. "But I don't want him dead. I want him helpless, deprived of his abilities."
"He's too dangerous to toy with, Goran."
"Think how we can use him," said Koblika.
"Use him?"
"You want the dreams to end, don't you?" Koblika asked. "You want to be free of that cage. This is how."
A sad smile crossed the Magos's face.
"Goran," he said, "you should have led with that. This will be a pleasure."
He closed his eyes and raised his hands. Quietly at first, the words started to issue from his mouth. Half-words, unwords, formless words. He began to speak them faster and more loudly. Koblika watched for a while, until the discomfort became too great. He picked up his assault weapon, left the gantry, and walked up two flights of stairs to an upper platform. Below him, the words echoed around the tower. On the platform, there was a modular container, a metal cargo pod from a commercial shift ship. It was battered and rusty. He disengaged the lock and swung the door open. The smell of decay that wafted out was sickening. Koblika backed away, his hand clamped over his nose and mouth. Organic waste fluid trickled out over the container's sill. He left the door wide open. He waited, Then he turned his back on the container and sat down on the platform edge beside the head of the stairs. Below him, the words grew louder. A light began to glow from the gantry below. It throbbed and grew steadily brighter. The machine hum in the tower grew louder. After a while, he heard a knock and a scrape as things stirred inside the battered cargo pod. He did not look around. Nor did he look around a few minutes later, when the first dragging, shuffling footsteps moved past him towards the stairs.
"So," said Drusha, "not that I'm saying I'm unhappy about it or anything, but how come you're not dead?"
Nail was leading them up the staircase towards the massive girder frame under the loom. He glanced back.
"I got shot, Magus. I fell," he said. "I survived both."
"Simple as that?"
"Luck is never simple," replied Nail. "Jaff got me in the back with a last shot. My jack armor stopped the worst of it, but the thing with jack armor is that it dissipates the force so it can't penetrate. The impact knocked me right over the rail."
"That's luck?" asked Drusha.
"I fell," said Nail, "quite a long way. But, as you may have noticed, there's a lot of machinery in this place. I bounced off some gigantic flywheel, banged up my head and my shoulder. Then I got hooked up by the strap of my rifle, wound up just hanging there from a cog, throttled by my own gun strap."
"And that's luck?"
"Well, it broke my fall," said Nail. "If it hadn't been for the cog, I'd have gone straight down to the bottom. I waited as long as I could, waited for the cog to cycle around, then cut the strap and climbed down some gears onto a platform."
"It's very interesting what you call lucky," said Drusha.
"I'm still alive, aren't I?" asked Nail. "That's the lucky part."
Drusha was fairly sure Nail was downplaying the cost of his escape. From the way he was limping, the way he was holding himself, it was clear he was carrying some considerable injuries.
They all were. Once they'd got Vorier out of his cage, using another of Drusha's patent wax charms, they'd patched him up as best they could, using the old medical supplies in the storage bins. His smashed arm was slung and bound around his torso, the most effective temporary splinting they could muster. He was very pale and very slow, and his pain was constant. Drusha was worried about the damage to Vorier's throat, too. He and Max were taking turns to support the interrogator so he could manage the steps. Max seemed robust enough, but the brawl with Streakle had left her bruised and sore. For his part, Drusha felt like he had been run over by a tank. His hand throbbed, and his chest, back, and belly ached so much it made him wince. Max had put a dressing over the slice Streakle had cut in his cheek.
"You're a silly bastard," she told him gently while she did it.
"You need to learn some new moves, Magus,"
Vorier had said, smiling through his pain.
"That's twice you've tried to get out of trouble by opening a cage and letting something wild out."
As they climbed, Drusha told Nail about Jaff and Eisenhorn. He related everything he could think of. "Have you seen Eisenhorn?" he asked.
"No," said Nail. "I haven't seen anybody. Not until they found you lot."
"Do we have a plan?" asked Max.
"Find a way out," said Nail. "Maybe try to use your wax charm trick on a door or something. You're all beaten up. I think Vorier needs serious attention. This is one of those times when we need to escort casualties out of the front line."
"No," said Drusha. "Eisenhorn's gone up to deal with Sark and Goblika. He'll need help. He's struggling. Something about this place hurts him." "Oh, screw him," said Max. "I told him once I'd got you out, I'd come back and help him," said Drusha. "He didn't come and help you," said Max. "No," said Drusha. "But then he never said he was going to. In fact, he said he definitely wasn't going to. I, on the other hand, said I would help him when I could." "So, what, you're a man of your word now?" asked Max.
"Always have been," said Drusha.
"With respect," said Nail, stopping so he could turn and look back at them. "I admire your spirit, Magus, but I don't know what sort of help you're going to be. Your expertise is not combat-oriented."
Drusha stared at him. Nail looked away, awkwardly.
"You know what?" he said. "I'm sorry I said that. I take it back. It takes balls for a man to go into a fight when he knows how to fight. It takes a damn sight more to go in when he doesn't. Not to have a clue, but to go for it anyway. Balls of steel."
"That's what we'll call him from now on," said Max. "Balls of steel." "Head full of stupid mind," she added. Nail smiled.
"This is a very big deal, isn't it, Nail?" asked Drusha,
gesturing at the machine above them. "What's happening here is,
"The biggest," said Nail.
"So then," said Drusha with a shrug, "Eisenhorn was right, really. We're all expendable. In the face of this. This isn't Eisenhorn's private war. The outcome affects everything we know, everything we are. Right?"
"Right," said Nail.
"So we should help Eisenhorn in any way we can," said Drusha. "I mean, we may not be any use at all, but we should try. How did you put it? To not have a clue, but to go for it anyway?"
"Something along those lines," said Nail. "I agree with the Migos," said Vorier.
"Shut up," said Max. "You can barely stand."
"Doesn't stop me agreeing, Marshal," said Vorier.
"All right," said Nail. "We go up. We take a look. If it's out of our league, we get the hell out. Find a way out of this place. Least we can do is get to Medea and get a signal sent."
"To the Ordos?" asked Max.
"Yes," said Nail.
"The Ordos?"
asked Vorier.
"I think we're way past hiding now, Dara," Nail said. "I think Eisenhorn would reckon so, too. We've got solid intelligence on the Cognite here. Old differences, they don't matter now. If we can't help Eisenhorn, we scream for help and bring the holy frigging Inquisition down on this place, guns blazing."
"Even if that means spending the rest of your life incarcerated?" asked Drusha. "Or being burned as a heretic? They still do that, right?"
"Even if," said Nail.
"Well, I agree with that last part," said Max. "Call in the Ordos, the Magistratum, the Territorial Guard, anything and everything. But for the rest of that big-talk pissing contest, I utterly despair of men sometimes."
"Me too," said Nail. "We're hardly packing much kill power."
Between them, Nail had his big Transvasor auto, Drusha had his Regit compact, which Max had recovered and reunited with the clip in Drusha's pocket, and Max had Shriekel's las pistol.
"Let's go, then," said Nail.
He turned and started climbing the gantry stairs again. Drusha took a turn supporting Vorier, and Max went ahead of them, behind Nail.
"Thank you,"
said Vorier quietly, as Drusha helped him up the stairs. Every step made him wince and sigh. "For what?"
"Not telling Nail what you know,"
said Vorier.
"About me, I mean. About what Eisenhorn said about me."
"Not my business," said Drusha.
"You blurted it out well enough down at the cages," said Vorier.
"Yeah, well, we're beyond that now," said Drusha. "And there's more than enough trouble to go around as it is." They hobbled on together, Drusha's arm around Vorier's back. "You should tell them, though," said Drusha.
"Who?"
"The Ordos. Your masters," said Drusha. "If you get out of here, you should go to them and tell them what you know, what you've seen, what you believe." Vorier nodded. "That's not good," said Max from up ahead. She was looking at the great machine above them. High above, at the very top of the tower, a strange glow was filling the air. It expanded, growing brighter and brighter. A breeze started to rise. The humming all around them increased. With a sudden but steady motion that startled them all, the huge wheels and cogs and gears of the loom began to turn faster, until they were spinning and rattling and whizzing. The slowly cycling machine had suddenly burst into frantic, industrial life.
"Yeah!"
Nail yelled back over the clattering roar of the spinning cogs.
"Not good at all!"
Chapter 20 Mindless. Eisenhorn stopped for a moment and crouched in the shadows. The sudden and furious din of the loom around him was making it hard to focus. Harder than before. The mere background hum of the cycling machine had worn him down and deadened his mind. It had taken him much longer than he had hoped to clamber up to the high levels of the tower. He was painfully aware of how old and unreliable his body had become. It was held together with augmetics and metal bracing. The slow climb had left him tired and short of breath. Now his mind, the part of him he'd always been able to trust, seemed as faulty as his body. He felt muffled, swathed in a darkness that limited his gifts. A migraine pain stabbed behind his eyes. The noise of the suddenly active loom was intense. It was like being at the heart of a Mechanicus factory plant. Sark, or Goblika, or both, had begun something. There were various possibilities, but the most obvious was that they were moving against him. He had considered simply sabotaging the loom. He carried two automatic pistols, the big Hecuta 45, loaded with standard munitions, which was in his hand, and a smaller Scipio compact, loaded with custom rounds, which was strapped in his chest rig. A few shots with the engraved rounds of the Scipio might damage the loom, possibly even destroy it. They were notoriously volatile devices. And he still had what scraps of his Psychana talent remained, and his small but potent vocabulary of enuncia. But if he managed to cripple and destroy the loom, what then? They were in X-timeate space. He'd die along with it. The Cognite's precious Gershom facility would be lost, but so would the vital things he had learned from Jaff about the King in Yellow, Sankur, and the Angelus subsector. A key threat would be stopped, but the greater threat would remain. Not for the first time, he focused his mind and tried to reach Betancourt outside in the Carinines. It was futile. Either the fold in space would not let his messages through, or his abilities were virtually gone. He feared the latter. The pain in his head was intense. He could barely form a thought, let alone try to send it. So, what were his options? He could push on to face Goblika and Sark, or he could get out. A word of enuncia had unfolded reality, bringing him and the group into Kestra. Surely another word would allow him to step out. And there was no guarantee that if he got out, he could ever get back in again. By his reckoning, the cage gantry was not far above him. The light was bright up there, a gold-amber radiance that turned all the engine mechanisms above him into silhouettes, and all the shadows below him into stark, hard edges. He had to go on. He wondered if he could. The etheric dissonance field generated by the loom had increased considerably when the machine started to run at full rate. It was no longer just dulling him and making him sick. It was actively tearing at his psychosensitive mind. He thought ruefully about Medea's last words to him. She'd been right. He should have brought Cherubael, despite all the handling problems that would have caused. He needed something that hit hard, like the monstrous demon host. He was alone and woefully weakened. He got up and began to move again, limping for the next metal stairwell. The first shots hit the platform deck beside him. Bright lasbolts buckled the grill and punched through it. Eisenhorn threw himself flat. There was very little cover. He tried to gauge the angle the shots had come from by the holes they had cut in the platform, but his facility for psychometric reading and prediction was as good as gone. The damn loom! It was neutering his mind. Another flurry of shots came in. One punched clean through the metal handrail above him. This time he glimpsed them in the air, glowing bolts, arcing down at him. He had some sense of an angle. He rose on one knee and banged off a series of shots with the heavy Hecuta, spent cases pinging out of the ejector. He saw the shots spark and flash as they struck metalwork above him. He saw a figure dart for cover along a catwalk, the tattooed man, Da Vinci, his twin las pistols in his hands. Eisenhorn fired again. In partial cover behind a flywheel, Da Vinci blasted back. The las fire went wide of Eisenhorn, to the left this time. The Cognite fool was a poor shot. He'd had three decent tries at Eisenhorn and missed by a margin each time. Eisenhorn crawled back until he was half-shielded by a spinning cog. He took careful, considered aim on the flywheel above, waiting for Da Vinci to poke his head out again. Eisenhorn focused his will.
Da Vinci!
It hurt, like a hot spike between the eyes. Eisenhorn tried again. A mental goad like that, particularly when you knew a man's name, was usually enough to jerk him out into the open. He got into the hindbrain and gave it a flick the target couldn't resist. Under optimal circumstances, he could psych into a man's head and make him jump to his death or shoot himself, a look of horror on his face as his body turned against him. But these circumstances were far from optimal. The loom's dissonance field was both snuffing out his psionic ability and reflecting what little he could broadcast. Eisenhorn began to move again, keeping low as he headed along the platform. Another burst of fire chopped at him, hard rounds this time, an assault weapon from the rate. The metal slugs ripped across the platform and sparked off a brass bearing behind him. Different weapon. This was someone else. Plague or Goblika, perhaps. Again, the aim had been wide. Were they all terrible shots? No, they weren't. The evidence was plain. Kestra was a vital facility, but the Cognite had only staffed it with a handful of operatives. Just enough to keep it running. So they had to be good. The very best. elite cult soldiers, hand-picked for their skills. Eisenhorn knew from the case file that Goblika was a fine marksman. He'd cut down Interrogator Arfen Cadel on Gudrun with a single headshot at 3,000 meters. These men weren't trying to kill him. They were trying to drive him. He kept low and scanned for movement. He glimpsed Plague, the short, jowly one, switching positions. Eisenhorn got off a single shot. Blague dropped out of sight. A moment later, he reappeared and hammered the deck beside Eisenhorn with auto-fire. Eisenhorn fought back the pain, clouding his head, and made a decision. He had to change tactics. He had to use whatever edge, whatever chance, however desperate, to seize back some advantage. They were trying to drive him. They wanted him alive. If he was their prisoner, he might be taken closer to the very place he was struggling to reach. But it had to be convincing. He rose to his feet, clearly visible. "You want to drive me, do you?" he yelled. "Heard me?" He fired two shots in Blake's direction. "I won't play your game," he shouted. Another fierce burst of auto-fire rattled into the decking beside him. Eisenhorn remained standing. He didn't even flinch. Blake reappeared, peeking down, his combat auto-rifle aimed at Eisenhorn.
"Comply now, or we drop you!"
Blake shouted.
"What the hell makes you think I'll cooperate?"
Eisenhorn yelled back.
"Look down!"
Blake called back, his aim fixed. Eisenhorn glanced down. He saw the gently wavering red dot of Blake's targeter floating on the center of his chest.
"We'd like you alive," Blake called, "but it's not essential. Take the stairs up.
Do it,
or I take the shot."
"Go to hell!" said Eisenhorn.
Blake had pushed it as far as he wanted to. He had no illusions about Gregor Eisenhorn's brutal and relentless reputation. He'd heard all the stories. He'd seen Jaff's body. The man was inhumanly dangerous. Damn Goblika's preferences. Enough chances. Enough playing with fire. Blake squeezed the trigger, ripping out a tight burst from his auto-rifle. The rounds hit Eisenhorn precisely where the marker had painted him, full in the chest. Eisenhorn reeled backwards in a puff of red vapor, hit the back rail of the platform, and slumped down. Blake slowly rose to his feet.
"Da Vinci!" he shouted. "He's down!"
Sprawled on his back against the rail, Eisenhorn lifted his head and his Hecuta.
"That's right. Show yourself, idiot," he murmured, and fired.
The large caliber round burst the top of Blake's skull. He swayed, then folded up in a heap. Eisenhorn slowly heaved himself to his feet. It was hard to breathe. His chest plating had stopped most of the burst, but his ribs were cracked, and his chest felt as if it had been crushed. One of the high-velocity rounds had punctured through the plate and done some soft tissue damage. Another had gone low under the plate, punching clean through him below his ribs. Blood was weeping down the front of his coat. He could feel more soaking his back. He concentrated and tried to use his will to block the pain and seal the bleeding. His will was gone. The loom had taken it from him. Da Vinci was standing behind him. Eisenhorn started to turn, but he was far too slow. Da Vinci whirled a spin kick that knocked Eisenhorn sideways, then another that flicked away the Hecuta. A third kick, straight to the sternum, put Eisenhorn on his back. Agony from the gunshot trauma flooded him. The tattooed man stood over him, looking down, both las pistols aimed at Eisenhorn's face.
"Look at you," Da Vinci sneered. "The famous Gregor Eisenhorn, scourge of heretics. That's over, you old bastard. What are you, without that famous Psychana gift of yours? Hey? Friggin' nothing. Just an old worn-out shell. A ruin. A nothing."
Da Vinci peered closer. He grinned.
"And you shot too. Dear old Blake plugged you. That'll be a through and through. You're gonna bleed out like a pig. That is, if I let you."
Da Vinci's smile grew broader.
"And you're gonna wish," he whispered, "that I had."
They climbed to the next platform and stopped to let Vorier rest. Nail kept watch. Drusha and Max eyed the hurtling gears of the great machine all around them with both fear and wonder. Max said something.
"What?"
asked Drusha. It was hard to hear over the clattering roar of the machine.
"I said it's giving me a headache," said Max,
raising her voice. Drusha nodded.
"The noise," he said. "And the light, And the heat!
She grimaced. The light shining down from above was brighter than before. It looked sickly and unclean, like the glow of something toxic and contaminating. It made Drusha remember a day, years before he had first met Max, when he had been caught out in the middle of the steppes of Lower Udar. He had hiked north from a grim livestock town called Kelikau, hoping to find a grazing station the men at Kelikau had mentioned. The station was long gone and derelict, and he'd been looking for alternative shelter when the thunderstorm came in. The light, the whole sky, had turned an extraordinary shade of yellow, a fulminous twilight to herald the fury. The light filling the tower looked the way the light had done that day, threatening and unnatural. He'd managed to trudge back to Kelikau, soaked, and spent a week in the infirmary, fighting off pneumonia. Drusha missed those simpler times.
"It's not just that," said Vorier from nearby.
He was leaning heavily against the metal handrail.
"The mechanism's generating an interference pattern. Background psionics. It's messing with us."
Max wasn't listening.
"What the hell's that?" she asked suddenly. "Nail? Nail!"
She pointed. There was a figure on a parallel catwalk some distance away. They could just see it, moving out of sight behind part of the loom mechanism. It was a human figure, walking quite fast, determinedly, arms at its sides.
"I don't know,"
said Nail, moving along the platform to get a better look, gun in hand.
"Cognite?"
asked Max. The look on Nail's face was doubtful.
"Another one,"
Vorier called out. A second figure had appeared on a platform several stages below them. This one was limping, almost shuffling, but though slower than the first, it seemed equally determined.
"Get behind me,"
said Nail. They turned. A third figure had appeared. It was coming up the steps towards them. It had once been human. It had taken considerable damage to the left side of its body and head. Its flesh was beginning to rot and discolor. Its good eye fixed them with an eager glare. What was left of its face was expressionless. It was moving fast, striding up the steps and onto the platform.
"Throne sakes!" Max exclaimed.
"Back up!"
Nail shouted at the advancing thing. He aimed his gun. The figure did not slow down. Nail fired, center mass. The heavy round had no effect. Drusha saw a telltale green shimmer around the figure, a pinprick green light in its empty socket, a crackle like electricity.
"Nail!"
he yelled. He pulled the gun out of his pocket and aimed. One shot. The auto snub jerked in his hand. Drusha discovered it was surprisingly hard to hit a target, even one as big as a human being coming right at him, just a few meters away. His shot simply clipped the figure's right shoulder. He was about to curse at himself when the figure went down. It went from walking to falling without an interruption. Suddenly slack, as dead as it looked, it crumbled, bounced off the handrail, and lay still.
"An animation," said Drusha. "Yeah,"
agreed Nail. He was taking the clip out of his gun and opening his pocket to fish out custom rounds.
"Like before," said Drusha.
"Indeed so, Megas,"
said Nail.
"Don't let them touch you,"
he yelled to Max and Vorier.
"Nail!"
Max called. Another figure was mounting the staircase at the other end of their platform. Before death, it had been a stern, older woman. Corruption had bloated and blackened her flesh. Green electric sparks floated in her dead eyes and fizzled around her bared teeth. She, too, was moving rapidly, coming right at them without hesitation. Max squeezed off two lasbolts at her. They were solid shots, but the energy just radiated away.
"Don't waste it," Nail told her. "It won't have an effect."
He slammed a specialized round into the chamber of his Tronsvasser. He stepped in front of Max and Vorier, aimed at the woman as she reached the head of the stairs, and shot her between the eyes. There was an ugly puff of matter. The woman's head snapped back, and she toppled down the stairs. She ended up at the foot of the steps, on her back, her legs tangled in the side rails.
"They've sent these things to get us, haven't they?"
Drusha asked Nail.
"Yes,"
he replied. He was loading another round.
"Raise them. That might be why the loom's working."
"But we can stop them,"
said Drusha. Nail nodded.
"But it depends how many of them there are," he said. "We've only got a few custom rounds between us."
"How many could they have made?"
Drusha asked.
"Depends how many people the Cognite have killed," said Vorier. "How many bodies they have." "Let's move,"
said Nail.
"Only shoot if you have to."
They hurried to the steps where the first figure had appeared. Max and Drusha helped Vorier between them. They moved down, but another figure had appeared, striding towards them. It was hard to tell if this one had been male or female in life. Its death appeared to have involved being flayed.
Up! Up! Nail urged them, guiding them to the side and up a link staircase to a higher catwalk. He waited as the flayed thing drew closer, then dropped it with a single shot. He hurried after the other three, up the steps and onto the higher catwalk. Be wary, he advised. These devils are much faster than the thing that came for us in Helter.
Because they're more intact, said Drusha. What? Asked Max. The thing in Helter was just old bones. This force animates them, but it can only use the structure it's got to work with. Simple mechanics, really. It can make disarticulated bones rise and shuffle along, but these poor creatures are intact. More or bloody less, said Max. They're articulated, said Drusha. They have tendons, sinews, muscle mass. The force can use that framework to move them faster.
I think he's right, said Nail.
I think he's writing a frigging paper on them, growled Max.
Keep moving, said Nail.
They followed the catwalk over a massive spinning drum of brass, then ascended another staircase to the next gantry. Vorier was struggling to keep pace. Twice he slipped and cried out as his broken arm struck the handrail. Another figure was waiting for them on the gantry. It was just dry, white bones. Green swirls of light imaged the organs missing from its torso. It shuffled towards them, feet dragging. Drusha raised his sidearm.
Don't waste a round, said Nail, grabbing his arm. We can outrun this one.
They left it behind, hustling Vorier along, and took another flight of stairs up to a wide catwalk that circled the base of a huge, burnished gyroscope.
Oh, terror!
Max exclaimed. Another figure was pacing inexorably towards them. Its face had been blown away by point-blank shots. But it was Hadid Garofar. Chapter 21 A Very Suitable Candidate. In his cage, on his knees, his head tipped back, Magos Sark crooned unwards into the gulfs of the Empyrean, and the words echoed back like the cheering of a trillion insects. The light flooding the tower was coming from inside him, so bright his skin was translucent, and Goblika was sure he could see the shadow of the Magos' skeleton. Goblika stood at the edge of the platform for a while, watching. The unwords stirred something primordial in him, as if some deep and vestigial part of his lizard brain was responding. It was the language of infinity, the pre-human, inhuman instructions for creation and negation. He tried to mouth the unwords he heard, to copy and repeat them, to learn them, but they were coming too fast. They always did. He had tried before, almost every time Sark had started the loom and begun to weave. Goblika had never managed to learn any unwords that way. He'd always ended up with a nosebleed or a savage tension headache. The futile effort to learn had, over time, only done one thing. It had changed the color of his eyes. The few words Goran Goblika did know, the few commands of power, had been taught to him by Lillian Chase, and each syllable had taken many painful weeks to master. Goblika realized he had been standing on the gantry for too long. The skin of his cheeks and brow was tingling and sore, as though he had been out in a strong sun. He'd been looking at the light for longer than he should have. He knew from experience that word burn could be more painful than sunburn. He picked up his auto-rifle and went down a small curved staircase to the monitor station, set up on a platform below and to the side of the main gantry. He checked the displays of the cogitators. Sark's psychometrics and vitals were off the chart, the former too high and the latter too low, but that was fairly standard when an act of weaving was in progress. Other cogitators were trying to map and decipher the sounds coming from the Magos, but their readings were void. Again, that was normal. The Cognitae had procured the most powerful cogitators possible, some taken by force from a Mechanicus facility in the Thracian system, but even these could not cope with the energy and raw data they had been set up to process. Goblika wondered how long Sark would last. No human body should have survived the extremes he had endured over the years. Indeed, none had, prior to Sark. As a junior adept at Kestra in the early days, Goblika had often been tasked with hosing out the cage after a failed trial. Sark should have died the first time he tried to harness the loom. He certainly shouldn't have been able to survive the many weavings he had conducted. But then, Goblika was certain that the process had altered Sark in fundamental ways. Sark had ceased to be remotely human a long time ago. What did that make him? A god? A demon? A eudaimonic spirit? Goblika was sometimes convinced that Sark's soul had burned out years before, and something else, some etheric sentience, had taken up residence inside him, wearing Sark's flesh like a borrowed coat. During the brief moments he became lucid, Sark always begged to be let out of the cage. Goblika wasn't sure it was Sark talking. It wasn't the Magos pleading to be let out of the metal cage. It was the thing inside him whining to be let out of the coat of flesh it was clothed in. Now, even the coat was wearing out. They needed a viable replacement, especially if they were going to honor the king's request to increase productivity. Goblika heard footsteps on the metal stairs behind him, despite the roar of the loom. Da Vinci was ascending to the control platform, half-dragging a heavyset man in a black coat. The man's hands were cuffed in front of him, and he was hunched over in pain. Da Vinci was all but having to force him to walk. But Da Vinci had a supremely satisfied look on his scrawny, tattooed face. "I got him," he said. Goblika walked over. The man in the black coat was standing with his shoulders down and his head bent forwards. He was breathing hard as if he had just run a marathon. Goblika saw blood dripping from his hands and from the chain of his cuffs. Goblika reached out, grabbed the man by the jaw, and forced his head up so he could look him in the eyes. Eisenhorn. The great and mighty Gregor Eisenhorn. His eyes were dead and lifeless. His skin was pale and blotchy, and blood ran from his nose. He was having trouble breathing. Goblika looked him up and down and saw the years of scar tissue, the old augmetics under the coat, the leg braces and strapped servo reinforcement. The man was withered and broken, and had been long before Da Vinci had got his murderous hands on him.
"I've looked forward to this moment," said Goblika. "Imagined it, you know. What I'd say. What you'd say. All that. But you're a lot less than I expected. Damaged and weak. And old. Bit of a disappointment, really." "Imagine," replied Eisenhorn, grunting the words out between rasping breaths. "Imagine how little I care." "Oh," grinned Goblika, play-acting scared. "Still got it, haven't you? Still got the old edge, eh? Or that's what you'd like to think. Give me some more, so I can tell people afterwards that breaking you was noble labor, not a piece of piss."
Eisenhorn didn't reply.
"Where's the blood coming from?"
Goblika asked Da Vinci. "Blake plugged him," Da Vinci replied. "Body shot."
"Did you patch it?"
"I didn't have a med pack with me," said Da Vinci.
"Well, get one. Now," said Goblika. "And get the kit, too."
Da Vinci nodded and moved to the lockers at the end of the bank of cogitators.
"Where is Blake?"
Goblika called out as he stood studying Eisenhorn. "Headshot," replied Da Vinci, sorting through supplies.
"Have you seen Strykal?"
"Not a sign," Da Vinci replied. He came back with a trauma pack. Goblika opened it, took out a tube of wound sealant, and rammed the applicator nozzle into the glistening hole in Eisenhorn's abdomen. Eisenhorn winced, but remained on his feet. Goblika pressed the activator and pumped sealant into the wound. Then he walked around Eisenhorn, yanked up his old black coat, and did the same to the exit wound. He tossed the tube back to Da Vinci.
"I said get the kit, Da Vinci," he snapped. "So, get the kit."
Da Vinci hurried back to the lockers. Goblika peered into Eisenhorn's eyes. Eisenhorn just glared into the distance and ignored the eerie, violet eyes fixing him.
"Did you search him?"
Goblika asked.
"Of course," Da Vinci called back. "A few bits and pieces. A backup gun in his chest rig. I took that."
"Now, what's going to happen?"
Goblika said to Eisenhorn, standing so close they were nose to nose.
"Is that I'm going to help you. That's a surprise, isn't it? I'm going to keep you alive. I'm going to take the pain away. All the pain, physical and mental. That frigged-up psycho mind of yours must be ready to burst by now. Right?"
Eisenhorn said nothing.
"This is a big day for you, you know," said Goblika. "Think of it like this is what your entire life has been about.
Everything you are, everything you've ever done, leading up to this moment. Right here.
I think he was trying to trick us, said Da Vinci, returning with the kid. You know, like, get caught. He knew he couldn't get past us, so I think he figured he'd let us take him so he could pull some stunt once he was here.
Is that it?
Goblika asked Eisenhorn, sidelong, as he prepped an injector.
That didn't work out so well, did it? If that was your plan, it turned into all kinds of shit, didn't it? And there's no one to bail you out, either. They're all dead. You understand that, don't you? They're all dead. All your followers and associates. And if they're not, they will be soon. The Magos is hunting them down, any that are left. His instruments are loose in the tower. Your friends, Gregor Eisenhorn, you've brought them to a very, very bad end. You know that? If there are any left alive, which I very much frigging doubt, their deaths will be the most awful thing you can imagine. I bet they wish they'd never signed on. I bet they wish they'd never followed you, and never trusted that you knew what you were doing. You know, I bet their last living thought is hate. Hate for you. Hate for getting them into this mess. Your friends will die hating you for.
They're not my friends, said Eisenhorn.
Goblika grinned and checked the dose load of the injector.
Oh, I don't think that's true. You've got to be a man's friend to follow him into hell.
Eisenhorn turned his head slowly and looked at Da Vinci.
He follows you, he said.
Da Vinci?
Goblika laughed.
He's paid to. Paid very well. Besides, he sees the bigger picture. The great reward awaiting all those who participate.
So do the people who follow me,
said Eisenhorn.
Do they?
Asked Goblika.
Do they really? Do you ever tell them, your friends, that you lied to them? That you are mad and outlawed and obsessed? That the path you walk is one of pain, and it's untrue? That your cause is doomed, and everyone knows it, even the Rot God King? Your side is the losing side. You follow the false emperor, Eisenhorn. You pledged your life to him. You backed the wrong side in this struggle. And that's just a fact.
We'll agree to disagree,
growled Eisenhorn.
No,
said Goblika.
From day one, since before the emperor was the emperor, it was always going to go this way. Ordained, predicted, projected, prophesied. Chaos will always prevail. It's a universal law. Order does not endure. Chaos overwhelms. Entropy, Eisenhorn. All systems break down eventually. Everything wears out. Everything falls apart. The universe returns to its preordained natural state. And that's chaos. Forever and always.
Eisenhorn remained silent.
You don't have to take my word for it, said Goblika. I'm going to show you. That's part of my gift to you today. I'm going to share the truth with you, the truth that's always been, so you can see it and know it for yourself. The scales will fall from your eyes, man, and you will think yourself such a fool to have believed otherwise.
You don't know me very well, do you?
Asked Eisenhorn.
See this?
Asked Goblika, raising the injector.
Sark's masterpiece. An engineered viral inoculant. A miraculous thing. He isolated it from samples collected by his grandfather.
The torment, said Eisenhorn.
Goblika grinned.
A man of learning. Yes, the torment. Ulren's pox. It had so many wonderful names. A gift of the warp. A pestilence like no other. This is inert, of course. An antigenic sac engineered from the original pathogen. It won't kill you. Well, It probably won't. It will transform you. What you are. How you think. It will remake you in wonderful ways. The way Sark remade himself so he could operate the loom.
Why? Asked Eisenhorn.
Why what?
Why are you giving it to me?
Well, said Goblika, for one, it will transfigure you and allow you to see the truth. And?
Make me, what, join you? Asked Eisenhorn. Pretty much, laughed Da Vinci. That won't work, said Eisenhorn.
Ah, said Goblika. Of course, because of your infamous willpower. Your will, so firm and unshakable that no temptation or malice can topple it. Eisenhorn, listen. I may have mocked you, but I'm not an idiot. I know you're a man of considerable talents and abilities. Your career shows that. You have particular strengths and skills that could make you very useful to us, to Lillian. Not in your present state, of course. I know you'd never join us. I respect that even. But this isn't a choice you're going to make.
Eisenhorn glared at him.
Seriously, said Goblika, the torment antigenic is horrible. This will hurt. Most subjects do not survive. Only Magos Sark has ever lived through more than one shot of it. But I think you will, simply because you're so strong. And the inoculant, once it's scorching through your system, will have plenty to work with. That psycho mind of yours, for example. You have walked in the dark for too many years, exposed your psi-active mind to the warp. It's left its imprint on you. You are an etheric sensitive, far closer in nature to the creatures you hunt than you'd ever care to admit. You are ripe and ready, a very suitable candidate.
Where do you want it? Da Vinci asked.
Throat,
replied Goblika. He looked back at Eisenhorn.
Forget your will, he said. Forget resisting. It's not a matter of that. The torment antigenic will modify you, alter your entire state of being. You will see the warp and be the warp, and that will be all. It won't be a matter of accepting it. It will simply be true.
You're very certain of these things you keep describing as facts, said Eisenhorn.
It's my job, said Goblika. My service to Orpheus, the king in yellow. He trusts me to get it right.
He glanced at Da Vinci.
Hold him steady, he ordered.
Da Vinci closed in, reaching up to drag Eisenhorn's collar down and expose his throat. Goblika stepped forwards with the injector. Eisenhorn's hands were cuffed with military-issue binders. He couldn't pull them apart, so he clenched them together instead, fingers intertwined. As Da Vinci closed in to seize him, he swung his fists like a club into the tattooed man's gut. He was not as tired and weak as they had presumed. Da Vinci barked out air and doubled up. Eisenhorn brought his hands down, now separated, so that the cuff chain hooked around the back of Da Vinci's neck. He slammed down, driving Da Vinci's face into the metal bracing of his rising kneecap. Bone cracked. Da Vinci fell away, moaning and choking. Goblika was lunging in with the injector. Every movement hurt. Eisenhorn's gut wound was severe, and just moving abruptly, raising his knee to take down Da Vinci, had torn the traumatized wound and broken the sealant packing. He felt blood suddenly spill down his back. He raised both arms and blocked Goblika. Goblika was bigger than him and much stronger. He elbowed Eisenhorn's block aside and punched him in the jaw. Eisenhorn staggered a few steps, inadvertently stepping on Da Vinci's splayed fingers. Da Vinci was down on his hands and knees, trying to recover. He yelled in pain as Eisenhorn's iron-shod boot crunched across his hand. Eisenhorn turned and kicked Da Vinci in the rump, throwing him flat on the deck in Goblika's path. Goblika vaulted the fallen man deftly and came at Eisenhorn again. With his hands cuffed, Eisenhorn could only upper block to one side or the other. Goblika feinted a punch from the left, then kicked hard with his right foot. The kick hit Eisenhorn in the hip, but his bracing armature took more of the force. Eisenhorn swung his fists at Koblika, but the man leaned out of the swing, then lunged in and caught the chain of Eisenhorn's cuffs with his left hand. He wrenched Eisenhorn's hands and arms down and to the side. Eisenhorn had no choice but to twist away, exposing his neck to the injector Koblika was stabbing in with his other hand. There was no point fighting Goblika's haul on the cuff chain. Eisenhorn went with it instead, allowing himself to be dragged down. He ducked into the stabbing motion and rammed his shoulder into Goblika's chest. Goblika stumbled backwards, cursing. He had dropped the injector. He reached for it. Eisenhorn kicked it further along the deck.
"Is this it?" Goblika taunted him angrily. "Is this the trick you are going to pull? The stunt you are waiting to play?" "Seems to be working," growled Eisenhorn.
Goblika sprang at him. Eisenhorn blocked again with both forearms, then swung his fists together hard. He caught Goblika's bearded jaw and knocked him sideways across the platform. Goblika crashed into the bank of cogitators. A screen smashed. Data slates tumbled to the deck.
"Freaking help me, you idiot!"
Goblika yelled at Da Vinci. Da Vinci was getting up. His nose and lips were a mangled mask of blood. He spat, drawing one of his las pistols.
"Don't kill him!"
Goblika ordered. The tattooed man cursed aloud and went for Eisenhorn. He twisted the las pistol in his grip and began to beat at Eisenhorn with the weapon's butt. Eisenhorn tried to evade. He raised his chained fist to deflect the blows. Da Vinci kept hitting. Eisenhorn ducked low and hooked the cuff chain around Da Vinci's elbow. Eisenhorn locked his fingers and swung, throwing Da Vinci off his feet. He landed hard. Eisenhorn kicked him to keep him down and unlaced his fingers, freeing his cuffed hands from the man's arm. But Goblika had grabbed him from behind. He had the injector again. Eisenhorn tried to tear himself away. Goblika stabbed in with the needle. Eisenhorn got his hands up, trying to block. The injector's needle wedged in the taut loops of the cuff chain, centimeters from Eisenhorn's throat. Eisenhorn twisted his wrists, and the cuffs plucked the injector out of Goblika's hands. It went flying down the platform. Goblika broke off and turned to run for it. Eisenhorn moved after him, but was tackled from the side by Da Vinci. Together, they slammed into the cogitator bank. They grappled. Teeth gritted, hissing blood, Da Vinci clamped his hand around the back of Eisenhorn's head and rammed his face into the edge of a cogitator's casing. Eisenhorn stamped back into Da Vinci's shin. As the man screamed in pain, Eisenhorn rotated, grabbed him by the front of his jacket, and heaved him into the bank of screens. Another shattered, billowing sparks. Eisenhorn had his weight on him. Da Vinci couldn't pivot. He reached up and clawed at Eisenhorn's throat. He got a grip and began to throttle, his fingers biting into Eisenhorn's neck. Eisenhorn let himself be pulled down. He let go of the tattooed man's jacket and allowed his hands to slide up the man's chest until he had a hand on either side of the man's neck. The cuff chain bit down into Da Vinci's throat. Da Vinci started to splutter and choke, spitting gobs of blood. His legs milled wildly. He let go of Eisenhorn's neck and began to pummel frantically. Eisenhorn knew he didn't have time to finish the kill. Goblika was coming in again from behind. He grabbed Da Vinci by the shoulders, pulled the thrashing man around, and smashed his head backwards through a cogitator screen. Da Vinci slithered out of the unit in a shower of broken glass and tubing valves and fell sideways onto the deck. Eisenhorn turned to meet Goblika. Goblika circled, head low, tossing the injector from hand to hand like a knife, daring Eisenhorn with each hand. He dummied, then lunged, the injector in his right hand. Eisenhorn sidestepped and tried to sweep Goblika into an overextension with his cuffed hands. But Goblika was sure-footed, and he shoulder-barged Eisenhorn in the belly. He carried him backwards and drove his spine into the platform's handrail. Searing pain flared from the exit wound as it hit the rail. Eisenhorn gasped. Goblika drove him again, then threw a low punch into his gut to agonize the entry wound as well. Eisenhorn stumbled sideways, flailing with his cuffed hands, trying to keep Goblika at bay.
"We're done, you old bastard," said Goblika, panting and wiping his mouth with the back of his hand. He hawked and spat on the deck. "All done now."
Eisenhorn swayed, leaning on the handrail to stay upright. He clawed with his cuffed hands and found the injector sticking out of his neck. He tried to pull it out. His fingers were numb and wouldn't work properly. He fell to one knee, gasping. He finally managed to yank the injector out, but he could see it was empty. He looked up at Goblika. Da Vinci hobbled into view, dripping blood. He clutched Goblika's shoulder for support.
"You get him?"
he asked through swollen lips.
"I got him," said Goblika.
Chapter 22 Sark's Instruments. "Look away," said Drusha, simply. He grabbed Max. pushed her face into his shoulder, and fired. The shot went through Hadid Garifar's chest. The pinpricks of emerald light in what had once been the deputy's eyes went out. His body fell back hard on the catwalk decking. Max looked up at Drusha. Her eyes were streaming with tears.
"Those bastards," she whispered. "I'm going to kill all of them."
"Keep moving, keep moving," Vorier yelled.
More animations were approaching around the curved catwalk. One was a rotting thing, the others two skeletal horrors that looked like they had been burned and fused, all crackled with green electricity. They all advanced slowly, one halting step at a time, but a fourth appeared behind them. It was Deputy Edda. Her eyes were blank, and her throat was a black mess of clotted blood. She pushed past the skeletal things, advancing swiftly, with expressionless determination.
"Go!" shouted Nail.
He knocked Edda down with a single shot, then turned to run after the others. Drusha and Max were almost carrying Vorier. He was murmuring in pain from the vigorous motion. There was no time to be gentle about it. They came around the curve of the catwalk. There were two more animations right in front of them. One, the closest, was a stained brown skeleton, draped in tatters of skin and disintegrating clothes. The other, a woman, was a mangled nightmare that looked like it had been systematically pulped with a hammer. She was moving fast, blood leaking from her ruptured flesh. Drusha fired, but he was hasty, and his shot went wide. He fired again, and the mangled thing dropped bonelessly onto the deck. But the skeletal animation was right on them. Max yelled and shoved Drusha and Vorier out of the way. Vorier fell hard, jolting his arm and shrieking. The skeletal thing reached for Max, clawing, but she evaded, and turned her dive into a tumble that took her out from under its swinging arm. It turned instead on the helpless Vorier. Soil-caked finger bones grasped at him, flickering with the lambent ghosts of the flesh and tendons that had once been there. Vorier tried to crawl out of its path, dragging urgently with his working arm. Drusha shot it point-blank through the back of the skull. The cranium exploded in a shower of bone shards and old loam, and the entire skeleton disarticulated, falling in an avalanche of disjointed pieces. Nail hauled Vorier to his feet.
"The stairs!" he barked.
There was a long ascending flight to the next platform level, further down the curve of the catwalk. Max grabbed Drusha by the hand, and they started to run. Ahead and behind them, they could see more animations, slow plodding things of bone and faster striding things that still had some or all of their soft tissue. The closest was a grim cadaver with an arm missing. Ghostly green light flickered an afterimage of where the limb had been. Drusha shot it in the chest. He turned his aim towards the other advancing animations.
"No, Megas, we can make it,"
Nail advised. He had Vorier hoisted over his shoulder.
"Don't waste any more rounds."
"All right,"
Drusha agreed.
"How many have you got left?"
asked Nail.
"I don't know. How many fit into one of these?"
8, snapped Nail. "How many did you fire?"
"I have no idea. Stop asking me questions,"
Drusha replied.
"How many have you got left, Nail?"
asked Max. They had reached the foot of the stairs. The nearest animations were rushing to block them, marching briskly, like passengers late for a transit. One was a woman with part of her face missing. The other was a man who had no head at all. Nail put a careful shot into each of them. They toppled.
"How many shots, Nail?"
Max roared.
"Now,"
Nail replied.
"None."
They ran up the stairs. It was a long flight, straight up to the next level. Drusha and Max led the way, with Nail lagging behind, supporting Vorier. Animations were closing in at the stair foot. From somewhere very high above, somewhere up in the sickly light, they heard a scream. The sound of a man in unbearable anguish. It rang out for several moments above the din of the working loom, then faded.
"That was him,"
said Nail, a look of horror on his face.
"Eisenhorn?"
asked Max, looking back at him. Vorier nodded.
"I think Harlan's right," he said.
"We keep going anyway,"
insisted Drusha. He took another couple of steps, looked up and saw a hunched, stained skeleton looking down at him from the top of the steps. Jade light glinted in its vacant orbits. It began to step towards them.
"Back,"
he said.
"They're already on the stairs,"
Nail shouted. Drusha raised his pistol and fired. The shot clipped the animation's head above the left eye, splintering bone, and almost swung the skull around through 180 degrees. The animating force in it broke and died, and the bones collapsed and tumbled down the steps. Some dropped over the edge through the rails. Max and Drusha flinched to avoid the ones that bounced past their feet.
"Get moving,"
Nail shouted from behind them. They started to run. Drusha wondered what else might be waiting for them at the top. "What does it mean when a gun does this?" he asked, showing the pistol to Max as they took the steps two at a time. The slide was jammed and locked all the way back.
"It means it's empty," she replied.
She looked back at Nail.
"Nail, we're all out of specials," she cried.
"Damn," said Nail.
"Nail!"
she cried. She'd seen something behind him. The animations were already ascending after them, the slower ones hobbling one step at a time. But one was moving fast, much faster than the others. It was pushing past them, scrambling after the four fleeing humans. It was lithe, jet black and gleaming. Max realized that its strange appearance was simply because it was covered, head to foot, in promethium residue. It was Streaker. The oil filming her staring eyes was backlit by the green glow inside her head, like a rangefinder in a battlesuit's visor. Her mouth was open and slack, and viscous ropes of promethium drooled out of it.
"Move, move, move!" yelled Nail.
He wasn't sure if he and Vorier could reach the top of the stairs before Streaker reached them, but he knew for sure that even if they did, they no longer had any way of stopping her. They ran for the top of the stairs. Nail picked up Vorier again. Drusha and Max reached the top. They looked around. There was nothing on the platform, no horrors looming to grab at them. They turned.
"Nail, run!"
Drusha yelled. He unlocked the slide and fired his pistol at Streaker, hoping Max was wrong. The snub simply clicked dry.
"Come on! Come on!" he yelled.
"Just get clear!"
Nail roared back, straining at his limit to run and carry the interrogator. Streaker was only 20 steps behind them, ploughing up the stairs tirelessly, the light gleaming off her oil-swathed form. Max drew her las pistol.
"That won't do any good," Drusha yelled at her. "Haven't you got the hang of this yet? Normal fire won't..."
"Shut up," she cried. She was fiddling frantically with the weapon, unlocking and resetting the power cell. With a snap of her wrist, she pulled a connector loose, then rammed the energy clip back in. Nail and Vorier reached the top of the stairs. Drusha grabbed them and hauled them onto the platform so violently all three fell sprawling together. Max turned to face the oncoming Streaker. The glistening black figure was only a few meters away. She could see the oil welling out of Streaker's open mouth and spattering down her chest. Max dropped the las pistol onto the top step.
"Everybody down!" she yelled, throwing herself clear.
Drusha heard a high-pitched whine. It got fiercer and louder, a warning signal. Max had rigged the pistol's energy clip to overload and discharge. Streaker reached the top 5 steps. The pistol detonated like a small bomb, releasing all of its significant charge in one bright flash of energy. The blinding explosion blew the weapon apart and took the upper 3 steps of the staircase with it. Metal shattered, handrails buckled and spun away. The expanding ball of heat and light enveloped Streaker. It didn't harm her at all, but the promethium vapor fuming around her ignited. She was engulfed in a sheet of flame, becoming a burning effigy of a human figure. She kept moving, but the top of the staircase, wrecked by the blast, was shearing away from the platform. The entire stair structure broke away from the top, dipping slowly and catastrophically into space, spilling the animations, fast and slow alike, off its collapsing length. They dropped away into the darkness below, some glancing and bouncing off the gears and struts of the whirring machine. The staircase broke off at the base, wrenching away from the catwalk supports, and tumbled after the things it had shrugged off into the air. It fell, grinding and screeching, bending and crumpling. Streaker fell, arms and legs moving uselessly. Like a comet, trailing fire, she dropped into the depths. The flames of her descent were visible long after all the other plummeting animations had vanished from view. Then her light vanished too. She had gone back where she had come from, down to the very base of Kestra's tower.
"Holy throne," breathed Drusha, looking down.
Far below, the darkness winked and flickered. There was a sudden glow, red and dull, that swiftly grew brighter and more fierce. The Promethean sump at the base of the tower had ignited. Chapter 23. The Torment. The fire had been burning for a while. At first it was far away, down in the darkness where no one could see it, just a dull red glow, roiling in the blackness. It looked as though it would never be serious, never really catch hold, that it would burn itself out and grow cold. But fire has been deceiving man since it was first given to him by the gods, or since he first stole it from them. Stories differ. The only truth that matters is that fire likes to betray. It has burned man's hand since first he took possession of it. When he thinks it is extinguished, it leaps back into life and reveals itself in fury, suddenly overwhelming, all-consuming, and too strong to fight. So with this fire. From the dullest glow to a seething inferno, from nothing to everything, in the beat of a heart, taking hold, devouring all, leaving nothing but ashes. Its heat was upon him, stifling him. Its light was in his eyes. His skin was blistering and flaking. His bones were beginning to fuse and melt. He heard the constant rattling of the loom, spinning towards eternity, despite the conflagration that enveloped it. But the noise of the loom and the roaring rush of the fire were both drowned out by the churring in the air, the clicking whispers, the sounds of a trillion invisible insects stridulating in the back of his mind. He could bear the heat no longer. He was being burned away. The door to the dark room was open, and hard sunlight shafted in from outside. Despite its glare, the light looked cool compared to the flames that lit him from head to toe. He got up to reach for it. He pulled his burning body from the rough cot to claw at the light.
"Stay still," the robed man said gently.
"I burn," he gasped.
"It is the torment," the man told him. "I'm sorry. This is what it does. We have tried many things to ease the pain. Stasis fields, ice baths, opiates, induced coma. Other victims have told me that it burns like hell's fury, even in their dreams."
"Is this a dream?" he asked.
His voice was small, without substance, like burning paper lifting into the air as it crisped away.
"I'm sorry, no," said the robed man. "Lie back. You are too weak."
"I will get up," he insisted.
He hauled himself up. The robed man reached to steady him. "Why aren't you burning?" he thought. "I am on fire. You touch me. Your hands are on me. Why aren't you burning too?" He shuffled to the open door. The robed man supported him.
"I don't know your name," the robed man said. "You were brought to us in this condition. You carried no identity. These are the first words you have spoken."
My name is Gregor. Gregor Eisenhorn."
"I will do all I can to help you, Gregor Eisenhorn,"
the robed man said softly. They stepped out into the light. The air was humid. He could see the deep blue sky above. He could smell the sea. Beyond the old stone walls of the garden, lush green vegetation rose, the skirts of a rainforest that blanketed the sheer flanks of the volcanic flue that stood in the distance, a ghost in the heat haze. The churring of the insects was louder, uncountable insects chirping in the jungle thickets beyond the ancient walls.
"Where is this?"
Eisenhorn asked, squinting in the bright sunlight.
"Is this some other part of Kestra?"
"I don't know where that is," said the robed man.
His robes were pure white. His skin was very dark.
"I haven't heard of it. Is it where you were?"
"Then have I folded again?"
Eisenhorn asked.
"Is this another extimate overlap?"
"I'm sorry, my friend," the robed man said. "I do not understand the terms you use. Gregor, your fever is so high it cannot be measured. You are hallucinating, I think. Hallucinating and confused. You have contracted a pestilence. It is called Ulrin's pox. It is severe, I'm sorry to say. Your confusion is part of the illness. I should return you to your bed."
Eisenhorn looked at him.
"Are you one of Goblika's people?"
he asked.
"I don't know the name, Gregor."
"Are you a doctor? A medicae?"
"I care for those who come here,"
the robed man said.
"I am Baptrice."
Eisenhorn looked around the garden. His raised voice had attracted attention. Three sisters, in stark white robes and starched bicorn wimples, observed him with concern. A grizzled old man sat on a garden seat beside the wall. He was naked, except for an old ammunition belt, and his left arm was nothing but a mass of old scar tissue. He was putting brass shell cases into the loops of the bandolier, and then taking them out again, counting each time.
6, 7, 8. 6, 7, 8. "What is this place?"
Eisenhorn asked.
"The hospice of St. Bastian," the robed man said.
"On Symbol Iota?"
Eisenhorn asked.
"Yes," said Baptrice.
You know where you are, then?
What year? What year is it, sir?
Gregor, it is the third year of the Genovingian campaign, and...
Eisenhorn broke free of his hands and walked out onto the lawn. The insects were so loud.
Gregor, called Baptrice. You are lucid. I have never seen such lucidity in a patient so tight in the grip of the torment. I would like you to speak with someone, if you are able. He might learn a great deal from you.
Who?
Asked Eisenhorn.
His name is Sark, said Baptrice.
Draven Sark?
No, sir, said Baptrice, frowning. Lemuel Sark. Higher Administrator Medica Lemuel Sark. He is visiting us. His speciality is Materia Medica, and...
I want to leave now, said Eisenhorn.
That cannot be permitted, said Baptrice, sadly.
Why are you showing me this?
Eisenhorn asked.
Showing you? What?
Asked Baptrice. Eisenhorn wasn't talking to him. He was staring down at his own hands. Old hands marked with old scars, hands that were dirty with soot and machine oil, hands that were covered in yellow blisters from the fire that was eating him away.
Why are you showing me this?
He asked the fire in his blood.
This is your place of birth, where the truth of you crossed Sark's path and the connection was made, where the infection began, carried not as a disease, but as an idea, from father to son to grandson.
Sisters,
Baptrice called. There was worry in his voice.
Help me conduct this poor soul back to his confinement. He is delusional and very sick. I fear for his safety out here.
The sisters approached. Their robes were ice white, and their horned cowls trembled as they walked. There were more of them than before. 10, 15.
Come, Gregor, said Baptrice. Let me take you back. Let the fever run its course. There is hope yet.
There was no patient with the torment housed in this place, said Eisenhorn. No outbreak occurred here at the hospice. It was an asylum. There was only a survivor. One man, an inmate who had survived the pandemic. I have read the reports. This is a lie. You are a lie.
Help me with him.
Baptrice smiled. The sisters closed around, their white bicorn wimples like tusks in the sunlight. More of them now. 40, 50.
I want to leave,
said Eisenhorn.
Restrain him gently, Baptrice said. He knows not what he says.
The sisters surrounded him. There were more of them now than there were chirring insects in the jungle outside. Eisenhorn staggered through them, brushing aside their phantom hands and their snow-white robes. He started to walk, pushing them aside. Somewhere, a cloister bell began to ring. He reached the iron gate in the old garden wall. Beyond, the green darkness of the jungle swarmed with the fricative words of insects. The flames swirled around him. He opened the gate and stumbled through.
I suppose you get a lot of cases like mine,
sniffed the small man waiting for him on the other side of the desk.
Cases?
Asked Eisenhorn. The room was cool and grey, as if it were raining outside, or the place were always starved of light. There was a large ornamental fireplace that clearly had not seen a fire in centuries, a rug on the wooden floor, and two plain chairs on either side of the desk. The old man sat in one. A gilt clock stood on the mantel, ticking like an insect in a jungle thicket, steady and slow.
You may take a seat,
the small man offered.
Of your own volition. You might as well be comfortable. We're here to talk.
Eisenhorn sat. The old man was shriveled and bent, lost in the folds of his hand-me-down robes.
You get a lot of cases like mine,
he sniffed.
I don't understand,
said Eisenhorn.
Oh, you understand. You understand, sir. You just don't care. And because you don't care, you don't remember.
What am I supposed to remember?
Asked Eisenhorn.
The people you have ruined,
said the man.
How many is it? Lost count. I'm sure you remember the truly great ones. Pontius Glaur, you'd remember him. Stopping him was the making of you. Or was it the breaking? What about the others? The nondescript ones? The minor cases? The insignificant ones? The innocent? Do you remember them? Or are they just faces that passed you by? Do you remember me?
I remember this room, said Eisenhorn. I remember that clock, ticking like...
Oh, you remember the room, do you? That's nice,
said the man.
Of course you remember this room. It's where you brought them to, all of them. This room and 1,000 like it. A room in which to talk. A room in which to slowly dismantle a man's life. How many lives is it now? How many have you brought here? Not the notorious, vile ones. I mean the ones like me. The unfortunates. The ones who walked in off the street, troubled by some minor transgression, only to find they were going to be rendered down. Their pride, their hopes, their dreams, their lives, their livelihoods, their possessions. Did you pause to care for any of them?
I don't remember you, said Eisenhorn.
Rather my point, interrogator,
the man said.
Is it interrogator still? It was then. I'm sure it isn't any more. What are you now?
Nothing, said Eisenhorn.
Then we are turned about, sir,
said the small man.
For last we met, I was nothing to you. My name is Imus. Does that stir anything?
No.
No, of course not. You have always been very good at your job, sir. Very good. You have excelled in your duties. Shall I tell you why?
I feel you're going to, Master Imus, said Eisenhorn.
Because you never care,
said Imus.
You are without compunction. This allows you to perform your duty with intense purpose. No sentiment gets in the way.
Drusha said that, murmured Eisenhorn.
Drusha?
Asked Imus.
Friend of yours?
No. Imus grinned.
I knew the answer would be no, you see,
he said,
because you have no friends. No one comes close to you. You do not allow them to. A connection with another soul would be weakness. Which is why 100,000 people have passed through this room, and you have disassembled them all, and you cannot even remember their names. Now this heartless bearing of yours explains why you are very good at what you do. But it begs the question, why do it at all?
Why do it? Eisenhorn asked.
Yes, yes, keep up. Why devote your life to the protection of mankind when you cannot abide the close connection of another human being?
Ordo service is hard, said Eisenhorn. One must put aside certain things. One must stand apart and keep to the shadows. It...
Poppycock,
said Imus. He drummed his bony fingers on the desktop.
The ruinous powers, in your expert opinion, are they a contaminant?
Yes, said Eisenhorn.
Like an infection, a disease. Once contracted, even from the briefest contact with a carrier, never cured.
Yes, said Eisenhorn.
The insect tick of the clock was scratching at his mind.
It is the greatest horror of the warp. It never leaves a man once it has stained his hands. Corruption is inevitable.
Yet you have touched it, sir.
An obligation of my work, said Eisenhorn.
True,
said Imus.
Also true, and a fact you know well. All inquisitors end. They are, by necessity, finite. The work they do, how can I put it? It tarnishes them. They are carriers, infected with the torment of their duty. No matter how noble and dedicated, it gets them all in the end, doesn't it?
The Inquisition has safeguards.
Indeed it does,
said Imus.
Retirement from active service, restraint, incarceration. The Inquisition watches itself. When one of its own goes too far, becomes too lost, he is declared heretic as quickly and undeniably as any arch-enemy rogue.
That's how it must be.
But you consider yourself an exception?
Asked Imus.
No, I... Eisenhorn paused.
You always knew the path you were walking. You knew the cost. You knew the inevitable.
I always accepted that.
But now you deny it,
said Imus.
For so many years, sir, they tried to get you to stop, to retire before it was too late. Your friends, forgive me, I misspoke, the people you described as your friends, they all tried, didn't they? And you ignored them. Because you knew better. You overruled them. You cast them aside. They stopped being the people you described as friends. Some died, and you never cared. Some battled you to halt your progress, and you crushed them for it. And now you're here, in this room. Even the holy orders, which you claim to serve so dutifully, have declared you a heretic. Diabolus extremis. And yet they are wrong, because you know better. You will disregard their authority and carry on anyway, alone and friendless, though you always were, claiming to serve the Inquisition, even though it no longer wants your service.
I know things that... Imus held up a hand so small and scrawny it looked like a bird's claw.
No one's listening any more, sir,
he said.
Not even you. Look at yourself. Broken beyond measure. Obsessed. Serving on for decades beyond any point that is wise or healthy. Always driving forward because you know best. You serve mankind, but you have only contempt for the people who cross your path. You use people. You neglect any bonds that might be considered friendship and which constitute the foundation of humanity. You forget the faces and the names of those whose lives you change. People die for you, and you care not.
Imus pushed back his chair and rose to his feet.
You should think about it, interrogator,
he said.
Why you do what you do.
I know why, said Eisenhorn.
The thing is, you poor fellow, you don't. And it's right there in front of you, the truth, staring you in the face. You're so good at finding the truth, yet you fail dismally to find it in yourself.
And what is the truth, Master Imus?
Eisenhorn snapped.
Look at yourself, sir. "'And tell me what you would call a man like you,'
said Imus. "'Eisenhorn shifted in his seat uncomfortably. "'He looked at his hands and saw how badly they were seared. "'Blisters, contracture, third-degree burns, perhaps fourth. "'From the fire inside him.
"'Sir?'
Imus called out.
"'Are you quite well? "'You look rather ill at ease.'
"'I'm burning,' whispered Eisenhorn.
"'Like last time?'
asked Imus.
What?
When last we sat together in this room, you caught fire. Head to foot, I was most terrified. The fire, it burned your skin and roasted the flesh off your bones until nothing was left except a torched skull staring back at me.
That wasn't real, mumbled Eisenhorn.
No, it wasn't,
said Imus.
It was a trick. A wretched trick of your psyche mind. You did it to scare me, to make me quail. It worked. By throne, it worked. The most terrible thing, and I have never forgotten it, or forgiven you for scaring me like that. Do you remember why you did it?
To elicit a response.
To elicit a response,
cried Imus. He smiled and opened the glass front of the clock on the mantel.
That's it exactly. You did it to scare the crap out of me, pardon my language. It was intimidation, bullying. You've done that your whole life. You did it to get at the truth. Do you remember what you said about that?
No,
said Eisenhorn, racked with pain.
You said that fear simplifies the mind,
said Imus.
You said it is so strong and pure, it empties the head and removes all barriers and falsehoods. You scared me so you could read the truth inside me, the honest part of me that I could not dissemble.
It was a technique,
replied Eisenhorn, fighting to remain conscious. He rose to his feet, found he was too unsteady, and sat down again.
A standard Ordo technique. Just a mind trick. The fire burning me is real.
Imus craned his reedy neck and peered at the face of the clock. He began to adjust the hands.
Real?
He asked, as if only half listening.
What's real? Look at us here, in this room. What's real about that? It's just another technique, another mind trick, another phantom fire to burn through to the truth, to, how did you put it, empty your head and remove all barriers and falsehoods. Fear, sir, to simplify the mind.
No, said Eisenhorn. He took a deep breath. A shadow seemed to have passed over what little daylight existed outside, and the room was darker than ever.
It is the torment, the antigenic at work. It's a hallucination. Sark designed the inoculant to condition the mind, to strip away the will, to brainwash.
No, he didn't,
said Imus mildly.
That's not really what it does. It doesn't make you think differently, sir. It makes you think truly. It burns away all the psychological armor and rationalizations and excuses a man has accumulated through his life, and shows him the truth that's always lurked underneath it all. Like fear, it simplifies the mind.
Eisenhorn rested his face in his hands, his elbows on the edge of the desk, and concentrated to control his breathing and moderate the agony.
I'm weary, he said quietly. Of people telling me that I've crossed some arbitrary line. It's not the truth, and this delusion won't convince me otherwise. You're just an old memory, being used as a puppet by the torment antigenic to get me to confess to something that isn't true.
Of course it isn't true, said Imus. You haven't become a heretic. You are quite right to be resolute about that. Why, that absolute certainty is what helps you remain so defiant against accusations. You can conscientiously insist you have not become a heretic, no matter what your old masters say.
Eisenhorn looked at the old man.
The real truth, said Imus, with a smile, the thing we've met in this room to winkle out of you, is far more simple. Will you admit it to me?
I don't know what.
Then I will say it,
said Imus.
The warp has always been in you, right from the start. It has called to you, and you have followed it. You wear the robes of an inquisitor to get close to it, and you finish any who dare compete with you for its affections. You are not a heretic because the Inquisition has proclaimed you one. You have not slowly become a heretic after years of stalking the dark. You have always been one.
Imus grinned at Eisenhorn.
You must know that's the case,
Imus said.
Well, you must get a lot of cases like yours. You came to this place of your own volition. You know what happens in this room. You have always been a heretic, Gregor Eisenhorn. You simply haven't ever had the clarity to recognize the fact. You do now. The barriers are burned down. Fear has simplified your mind. You cannot dissemble.
No,
said Eisenhorn. He rose to his feet.
Come now, don't threaten me,
said Imus. He finished adjusting the clock and closed its case.
I've been dead for 200 years. You have never lived. You do not walk in darkness. You are darkness. It's always been too late to turn back. It's in your blood, like a fire that won't go out. You should accept it. That's what you told me, and 100,000 like me. Accept your transgression, and you will find relief. A burden lifted. Embrace it. The warp is your only friend, and it's been waiting for you for a long time.
Eisenhorn felt the flames rise up, eating at him eagerly.
"This is trickery," he insisted. "Fever!"
"No," replied Imus.
"It's the truth, which is always the most painful thing of all. End your torment, sir. Accept what you are. Acknowledge what you have always been. The pain will be brief. Beyond the pain, why, it is so very beautiful."
Eisenhorn shook his head. Fire was gnawing his bones away.
"You think the warp is your enemy," said Imus. "But it's the only true thing there is. The one constant. Your only friend. Species rise and fall. Imperiums come and go. The warp remains. Bow down and let it take you. It's what you've always secretly wanted."
The door banged open.
"Will this take much longer, Gregor?" asked Titus Endor. "I've got things planned."
Imus sniffed and looked at the clock.
"About time,"
he murmured.
"I was getting bored of this."
Endor drew his auto-snub and shot 4 rounds into the old man. Imus fell into the fireplace and smashed into 100,000 fragments of old Summiter-ware pottery.
"Come on," said Endor, grinning. "There's still time to get out. There's always time to get out."
He took Eisenhorn by the arm and bustled him out of the gloomy room.
"You'll burn yourself," Eisenhorn said, looking down at Endor's hand, gripping him.
"Anything for a friend," laughed Endor. "You and me, through thick and thin. You knew I'd always come back, if you needed help."
"From the dead."
Endor halted and turned to face Eisenhorn. He put his hands on Eisenhorn's shivering shoulders and looked into his eyes, serious and sober.
"Is this about the thing?" Endor asked.
"The business."
"It turned things bad between us, I know. Tell me you've forgiven me. You must have forgiven me by now. It wasn't my fault, you know. Just circumstances."
Eisenhorn looked away. He couldn't meet Endor's urgent gaze any more. There were things in Endor's eyes, writhing worm things like larvae, that pressed against the glossy windows of Endor's eyeballs. He looked around instead. A huge full moon, the color of flame, was rising over the desert flats. The vast sky was woad blue, speckled with stars. The endless sands were turmeric yellow. There wasn't a building around for 100 kilometers.
"Is this another stage of the fever?" he asked.
"The what?"
asked Endor. He began to walk, his boots kicking up fine dust from the soft yellow sand.
"Another part of..."
"Look, forget it, Gregor, will you?" Endor said. "I let you down. I shouldn't have. I'm sorry. Can we leave that business behind us? Come on, I've got to get you out of there."
"You shouldn't consort with me," said Eisenhorn. "I will destroy you."
"I don't need you for that," snorted Endor.
"I am disavowed and declared heretic."
"Well, you've always been a bit of a rogue."
"I mean it, Titus. The Ordos have cast me out."
"They got rid of me too, you know," said Endor. "Said I was, you know, unreliable. Took my rosette. Put me out to pasture. What does it matter? I've known you a long time, Gregor. I know what you are."
"And what is that?"
asked Eisenhorn. A sweet desert breeze rose, and dust swirled between them like smoke.
"A friend," replied Endor, with a smile and a shrug.
"I was never much of a friend to you,"
said Eisenhorn.
"Ah, I got used to you. And your ways," said Endor.
"I let you die,"
said Eisenhorn.
I think I knew you were sick. I suspected. I knew I couldn't cure you, but I could have come to find you. Made your last years more comfortable."
"You could have done," said Endor. "But let's face it, that's not you, is it?"
"And what is me?"
"Thrown alive," laughed Endor. "You're maudlin already, and we haven't even started drinking yet."
"What?"
"Come on," said Endor. "I can see you're thirsty. Let's put that fire out, eh?"
Figures had gathered ahead of them, a small group seated on rugs and blankets, around a crackling bonfire, under the wide starlit purple of the desert evening. Eisenhorn could hear talking and laughter.
"Look who I found," Endor announced.
The figures looked up. Some laughed. One handed Endor a bottle.
"About time you got here," said Midas Betancourt.
He was poking the fire with a stick. The campfire was built in a circle of broken stones, its flames and sparks roaring up into the night. The crackle of the wood was like the churring clicks of insects. Betancourt's cerise jacket looked like blood in the flamelight.
"Another hour or two, and there'd be no bottles left," said Harlan Nail.
He was lying back on an old Selgioni travel rug, his shoulders propped against a boulder.
"I'm sorry,"
Eisenhorn said to him.
"I was joking, boss,"
Nail replied.
"We brought plenty."
"No, I'm sorry," said Eisenhorn.
"You were always so loyal, Harlan, and I got you killed. A crass mistake on my part."
"Just circumstances," Endor said encouragingly.
"Listen to me," Eisenhorn said to Nail. "I shouldn't have trusted Jaff. That was a stupid error. But even before that, before the actual fact of your death, I placed you in danger so many times. I could have got you killed 1,000 times over before I actually did."
"Give him a drink for Throne's sake," Midas called out.
"He's maudlin tonight," agreed Endor. "Very maudlin. Up in his head, all brooding, as usual. I told him to lighten up."
"Did that work?"
asked Midas.
"Does it ever?"
snorted Nail.
"Here you go," said Kara Swole. She handed Eisenhorn a glass of Amasek.
"Kara,"
he said. He was so tired. His resistance was ebbing. They all looked so young.
"Good to see you again," she replied.
He took the glass. The heat of the fire inside him ignited the vapor of the Amasek. Tiny blue flames danced across the surface of his drink.
"Are you dead too?"
Eisenhorn asked her.
"As good as," she said. "I have walked in your footsteps. Your path only ever leads to one place."
"Kara."
"I'm joking. Throne, what's the matter with you tonight?"
"Some die outright," said a figure on the other side of the fire. "Some just end up damaged. Their lives ended, to all intents and purposes. It amounts to the same thing." Gideon Ravener gazed through the roaring flames of the campfire at him. He seemed much further away than the rest of them. He was young and handsome, his hair tied back in a long horsetail. He raised his glass. "Your health," he said, nodding. Eisenhorn tried to move around the campfire to approach Ravener. The fire somehow contrived to remain between them, keeping Ravener on its far side, constantly watching Eisenhorn through flames.
"Most perturbatory," said Amos, at Eisenhorn's side. "The way the fire moves like that, as if it is sentient, keeping one thing screened from another."
He glanced up at Eisenhorn and sipped his drink.
"Wouldn't you say so, Gregor?" he asked.
"Strange, indeed," said Eisenhorn.
He looked at the old savant.
"Do you recall the torment?" he asked.
"Which one?" asked Amos. "There have been so many."
"The torment, Amos. Ulrin's pox."
Yes. Sequestered order dossier 1767563 triple serif. Docket 991. Entered by rubricator Edric Kallik on..."
"Just the details, Amos."
"The first outbreak was recorded on Pyridi," said Amos, "some 34 years before a second pestilence occurred during the third year of the Genovingian campaign. Ingenious research by the scholars of Materia Medica revealed the plagues to be related forms of the same pathogen. It was untreatable, and the death toll across many infected worlds was immense. Thanks to the work of a recollector called Lemuel Sark, it was eventually identified to be a virus engineered by the ruinous powers. Indeed, its efficacy had been enhanced by Subjunctus Vallis, an apothecary of the Doom Eagles chapter Adeptus Astartes, who had himself succumbed and was under its malign influence. It would seem, you see, the pox had some self-possession. Gregor, a sentience. Ha ha! Just like the fire. Is that why you asked?"
"Just go on, Amos,"
said Eisenhorn.
"The torment took hold of Vallis's mind, the poor devil," said the old man, pondering the facts as he accessed them from his memory. "It acted through him, guiding his work so as to protect itself and propagate its curse."
Amos looked up at Eisenhorn.
"Hardly the subject of light conversation at a gathering of friends," he smiled.
"The torment, Amos. Might it also be an infectious idea, carried and transmitted by thought as well as body?
Well, I suppose. At a stretch.
Amos shrugged.
And if it was engineered into an inoculant, Amos, an antigenic, to transmit the idea alone, without the physical malady, to infect thought, not matter.
Gregor, said Amos, I have no idea who in the Holy Imperium would have the talent or means to perform such a feat, not even the most gifted Magos of Materia Medica.
Unless the torment itself willed it,
asked Eisenhorn.
Took, let's say, a gifted Magos of Materia Medica and showed him how the feat could be achieved. Transformed his mind to devise the technique required.
I would think, said Amos, it would need to also transform his mind to make him even want to do it.
A given,
Eisenhorn agreed.
So, in such circumstances, how could a man fight the antigenic? How could he stop it corrupting his system?
I don't suspect he could, said Amos. If the torment could overcome the will and physiology of an Adeptus Astartes.
It gets to what is already there, said Ravenna, through the flames. It burns through will to whatever lies beneath. The truth, I suppose you'd call it, prosaically. It doesn't turn a man into a heretic. It merely burns back everything to reveal the heretic that's always been there.
Endor had taken Kara in his arms, and they were laughing and dancing a tight and playful Zendoff across the old travel rugs spread out around the fire. There was no music. They were dancing in time to the crackle of the flames, the steady, churring beat of invisible insects, the tick of an old clock, the hum of words unsounded. Midas was clapping along. Nail was opening a bottle. Eisenhorn watched as Nail got up, walked around the campfire, and refilled Ravenna's glass. Ravenna looked up at Nail, smiled. They laughed at some remark.
Loyalty's a funny thing,
said Nathan Inchabel, perched on a rock nearby. The firelight flickered across his face. He looked at Eisenhorn.
Don't you think so? He asked.
I do,
replied Eisenhorn.
It is strong, yet it is fluid, said Inchabel. Strong enough to drag a man to his death, yet fluid enough to flow from one man to another. And it's heritable, too. Passed down through the genes, I suppose, like a living idea that will not perish. Thus it can survive a man's death and pass, say, to his son or daughter, so she might know that loyalty too, and be dragged down in her turn.
Not quite like that, Papa, said Thea, sitting on the sand by his feet. You can give your life to a cause, an ideal. You serve what you believe in. That's what you taught me.
That's what he taught me,
Nathan said, gesturing towards Eisenhorn with his glass. Thea Inchabel looked at Eisenhorn with violet eyes.
But that's true, isn't it, sir?
I have always thought so,
said Eisenhorn softly.
I died for you, said Nathan. I became a target because you were a target. And by association, any who stood with you were in the line of fire. In fact, I was bait. All your staff were. Murdered to draw you out. Oh, don't look at me like that. I don't care. I don't blame you. The work we do is not easy. I haven't come here tonight to twist your guilt.
Does he have any?
Endor laughed as he whirled past with Kara. Nathan chuckled. He looked down and rested his hand on his daughter's head.
I was so proud when she followed me into the service, he said. Proud of a legacy. My child, in sworn service to the Ordos, and to serve you, as I did.
He looked at Eisenhorn.
Like father, like daughter, he said. She became bait in turn.
Goblika knew what he was doing, didn't he? He knew how to draw you out, how to play upon what little sentiment you have.
Come off it, Nathan, roared Endor, as he and Kara danced past in the other direction. He has none of that either.
Or was it the other way around? Asked Nathan.
What do you mean?
Asked Eisenhorn.
Inchabel shrugged. You sent her after Goblika. You knew he would find out about her. Find out who she was. The family tie. The legacy link. Father and daughter. Sworn allies of the old bastard.
He wouldn't be able to resist killing her and using her as bait. Which means he'd show himself. What a cunning way for you to get Goran Goblika of the Cognite to give away his location.
It wasn't like that, said Eisenhorn.
No, it wasn't, Papa,
Thea cried.
killed her with an ursid, said Nathan, staring straight at Eisenhorn. In a cage. Threw her in alive. Oh, not before he had tried the antigenic on her and watched for days as she screamed through the torment. Another failed test subject. So, into the ursid cage with her. Nathan, Eisenhorn began. My child, Gregor. My child. Used as an instrument to advance your obsession. Used and thrown away.
As are we all, cried Nail, toasting.
Everyone raised their glasses and shouted the words.
What kind of man uses his friends that way?
Asked Loras Vibben, standing at the edge of the firelight, staring at the flames.
No one uses his friends that way, Vibben,
said Midas. You had a daughter too, Vibben said to him.
I'm sure she'll be here any moment,
said Midas. He took a sip of his drink.
Won't she, Gregor? My sweet little Medea. It can't be much longer before she joins the party too.
Eisenhorn turned from the firelight. Its raging heat was still inside him. He walked away from the little camp into the vast blue gloom of the desert night. The moon glared down at him. He heard laughter and voices behind him.
Gregor! Endor ran to catch up with him. Gregor, where are you going?
I'm not part of that,
said Eisenhorn.
Don't be daft. You're the reason it's happening, said Endor.
This is the torment,
said Eisenhorn.
This is the deep-stage corruption of the antigenic, breaking down my mind. Delusion, collapsing memories, psychic decay, annihilation of will.
Hey, we all have bad days, said Endor. It's not your fault, just circumstances.
Titus.
Yes, Gregor.
Old Hapshant.
Him.
Throne rest his bones,
said Endor. He took a swig from the bottle of Jolik he was carrying.
Why did he choose us? Eisenhorn asked. To be his interrogators, all those years ago.
Because we were the very best, Endor exclaimed.
He raised his arms and did a little capering jig in a circle around Eisenhorn.
Seriously, Titus?
Endor shrugged.
He saw something in us, he replied.
You know how he died, said Eisenhorn. Throne, you know too well how he died. The cerebral worms. They destroyed his mind. His judgment, his cognitive function. The doctor said after he died that it was hard to tell how long they had been there. Possibly for years, impairing his critical faculties. He had served for far longer than he was fit. Long past the point when the Ordos would have demanded an Inquisitor's retirement.
What are you saying? That we were recruited by a madman?
What if we were?
Asked Eisenhorn.
I think you'll find the selection screening for Ordo service is a little more rigorous than that, said Endor.
But he saw something in us, said Eisenhorn. In his madness, long before the outward signs were obvious. In that collapsing mind of his.
Yeah? Like what?
The spark of something he'd been hunting all his life. The likeness of the arch-enemy he had pursued for so long and so far into madness he could no longer distinguish between light and dark.
Endor frowned at him.
I'm no heretic, you ass, he snapped.
No, said Eisenhorn. At worst, I think you're a hedonist who never took anything in his life seriously enough. You liked the power of the rosette, the authority, the opportunities. Then, of course, your own madness came upon you.
He looked at Endor's hurt expression. He could still see the worms moving in Endor's eyes.
What does that make you, then?
Asked Endor coldly.
I think that's what I'm being asked to consider, said Eisenhorn. I thought this was brainwashing, but it's not. The torment, the antigenic, it has no agenda. It simply lays a man bare. It reduces him to his base elements so he can see himself. That is how it breaks will.
You're kind of babbling, you know that, said Endor.
I am on fire, Titus, said Eisenhorn. You can't see it. Maybe you can with those eyes. I am in agony. I burn to the marrow from head to foot with a blood froth. It is so intense now. I can scarcely feel it.
Have a drink, Endor suggested.
No, thank you, Eisenhorn replied. Titus, I've always hunted for the truth, my whole life,
and now I think I may have found it, and it terrifies me. To see what I am. To see what I may have always been. Goblika and the Cognite, all of them. They're fools. They want to destroy and torture. They want to annihilate. Their motives were simply to hurt me. But there is, I fear, a truth in their philosophy. Goblika has shown it to me. It's more than he knew. He dug into me to find something to break me, but he didn't have the first clue what he was going to find.
What's that, then? Asked Endor.
A man. Just like him,
said Eisenhorn.
No, that's wrong. More than him. Goran Goblika is a hired killer with aspirations above his abilities. He found someone like the people he serves. Lillian Chase, the King in Yellow.
He looked at Endor.
Could yellow mean flames, do you think? He asked. A figure burning from head to foot. On fire, entirely. A symbolic name for someone who has burned through and been transmuted. All that they thought they were, torched away, and only the truth left standing.
Gregor, said Endor, I want to say, just me to you, I have no bloody idea what you're on about.
Eisenhorn looked at him, hopelessly. He tried to put it into words, easy words, but no words would come out. Only strangled unword noises. Endor looked puzzled for a moment, then his eyes slowly gave way, and small worms started to writhe and slide down his cheeks. He stood where he was, frozen. The churring of the insects grew into a roar, a strident, loud, slow click, beating time to their din, the mechanisms of a clock beating out the seconds.
It's almost time, said Ravenna.
Eisenhorn looked up. He was standing in shadow. The huge arch of the Spacian gate was above him. The churring of the insects was the roar of the crowds lining the 18-kilometer route of the Avenue Victor Bellum. 2 billion cheering voices. He could hear the marching bands of the procession approaching, the grumble of war machines, the thump step of the Titan engines. He could feel the monumental noise vibrating his diaphragm. This was Thracian, Hive Primaris, the day of the great triumph. Ravenna was dressed in his finest raiment, his inquisitional rosette on his breast, just above the small tribe badge of Clan Esu Swedir. The Spacian gate was made of gleaming white ethersite, and it was so tall that great titans could march beneath its span. Ravenna looked up at it. He seemed so young and invulnerable. "This is it," he said, smiling. "Just seconds now. The moment of transformation." He looked at Eisenhorn. "Mine," he said. "Most particularly. But yours, too. This moment changes you. You are always driven, Gregor, but what happens here today, what happens to me, it propels you on from this point. With a fury, a rage you never lose, it sets you on the path into the dark places, and from here there is no turning back for you. Even though I try," he added, "I try my damnedest. You know what they make me do, don't you?
Hunt for me.
Hunt for you. Hunt you down as a heretic. It will take years, Gregor. It will cost us both. And then, at last, we will stand face to face in the King's City of Dust, and it will end."
"How will it end, Gideon?" Eisenhorn asked.
"Oh, how do you think?" replied Ravenna. "The pupil always outstrips the master."
You see the future, then?"
"Far-seeing," said Ravenna. "My personal heresy. My vice in the eyes of the Ordos. That's the walk into dark places that I'm going to take, because of this. Trapped in that box, struggling to free my mind and see into anything. It will damn me, and the Ordos will have the leverage they need to make me track you down and finish you."
"If you see the future," said Eisenhorn, "tell me this. Who is the King in Yellow?"
Ravenna smiled. "Haven't you figured that out for yourself yet?" he asked. "He's been there all the time, since the earliest days of everything."
"I feared he was me," said Eisenhorn. "What I would become somehow."
"Oh, he's that too," said Ravenna. "Come on now. You know what you are. Forget the future, Gregor. No man ever really prospered knowing that.
The past is much more interesting. Think hard. There are only seconds left. Think hard and see yourself. Consider the possibility that Master Imus was right.
No, he...
Just recognize what you've always been, said Ravana. It'll make it easier for you. No more doubts, no more struggles. Your way will become clear, and it will make it far easier on me, too, when the time comes.
He looked up. They could both hear the screaming note of aircraft engines as they began their low pass along the avenue. Lightnings, 12 of them. There were petals in the air.
Here it comes, he said.
He held out his hand. Eisenhorn reached out to take it, but his hand met metal. He was looking at the armored box of Ravenna's support chair. Transformation. The chair's voxponders crackled. Fire. Rebirth. Eisenhorn felt a flash. It was so bright he could see nothing but searing white. Then the flames came. The flames and the wind and the shockwave. His clothes burned away, blowing like ash from his body. His skin blistered, peeled back and shredded. Muscle and sinew disintegrated. His bones, black with heat, buckled and flew like twigs in the wind. She was holding his hand.
That was all a long time ago, she said.
Elizabeth.
The sky was white. Old trees shivered in the cold wind. They swayed, their leaves rustling like the chorus of insects. She led him across the wild fell towards the dark valley below.
Do you not suppose, she said, it's ironic? The only woman, the only person, you ever loved was a pariah. Untouchable and cast out. Anathema to human contact.
The thought had crossed my mind, he said.
The fire will end soon, she promised.
Too late, he replied. It has unmade me. I have rigged through my own ashes, and I understand.
So, use that, she said.
You have not been able to save anyone, not really. Not me, not Gideon, not Midas, not even yourself.
You are doomed, and always have been, and so are all who know you.
I should have stopped years ago, he murmured. The Magos was right.
Sark, she asked.
No, Drusha.
Him I don't know, she said.
He's no one, Eisenhorn said. Just a failed man, clutching at the scraps of life, bemoaning his lot. But he said to me that I had gone on far too long, that I had never worked out when to stop. He was very perceptive. He had given up, you see, far too early and far too easily. But he intuitively saw in me a man who had failed in completely the opposite way. A man who had just kept going past any point of reason. His friends begging him to halt, then falling at the wayside as he left them in his wake.
I didn't think you had any friends, she mocked.
Not any more, said Eisenhorn.
So, you see, nothing holds you now, she said. You can walk the last few kilometers without any burden. Nothing matters to you any more. Can you use that freedom for me?
To save you?
He asked.
She shook her head.
Far too late for that,
she replied. She smiled.
But a part of me. I will have. It's hard to explain. A daughter. That's the easiest word, but it's not accurate. She is of me, but she is also me. And another pariah. You've done enough, Gregor. Forget Chase and the king. If you keep going, determined to stop them, you will fail.
You'll never have the will, despite the uncommon will I know you have. You'll never have the will to finish this alone.
So do something simpler for me. Save her. Save her from the king before the king claims her. Let me have some afterlife in her.
Where is she?
He asked.
She'll be born 2 years from now, said Bequin. Deep in the maze, in the shadow of the city of dust. She will walk the streets of Queen Mab.
On Sankor?
Yes, like the Jaff woman said. That's where you'll find her.
Your daughter?
She's me, Gregor, said Elizabeth Beckwin. Beta to my Alpha. Think of her that way. And find her.
If it's the last thing I do, he said.
It will be, she replied. Stop hunting the great foe. You've done enough. You've changed the fate of the Imperium in significant ways. End your days with something smaller. One life.
Will the torment end, then? He asked her. Will the fire go out, then?
Between you and me, it will never go out, she said. But the pain will cease.